Blog Talk Radio.
Time now for Lydia's Literary Lowdown on Greater Good Ministries Radio. Join Lydia at 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern every Saturday and get the lowdown on today's popular authors, publishers, and pundits. Lydia's Literary Lowdown, right here on GGM Radio, every Saturday, 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern.
I have author Patrick Verdine right where I want him. I am going to beat him over the head with his brilliance and talent today. He has no idea coming on the air. I've given him hints, but I'm going to beat him over the head with his brilliance. I read The Monitor. If you have not read it, if you are a horror fan, you need to run. Do not walk. Run to Amazon and get this book. It's a novella. I keep arguing with Patrick. It should be a book. It's absolutely incredible. Patrick, how are you today?
I am doing very well, thank you.
I doubt that's the best introduction. I hope that I inspired just a tiny little drop of the fear that you instilled in me with this book.
You did. You know, you were really helpful kicking me in the butt and getting me to go on this. And it's funny you mentioned that it should be a novel because I started writing this a long time ago and kind of delaying on it. And I would get periodic kicks in the butt from you saying, hey, write this. And it really evolved and became a novella. And I think if I hadn't given myself a deadline for release, which was really important to me, because I have a tendency to not finish things without a deadline, that I might have turned it into a novel, but it might not have been released till like 2018 or something.
Well, you know, this could be, I'm arguing for a whole, you could make novellas yet out of this. Because the basic premise, I think I tweeted it, and you can follow Patrick on Twitter at Somnicide. You're not on there much, but I still love what you have to put out there. And yes, that is me chastising you because I'd like to see more sales of The Monitor. Anything to get you producing more because your voice is singular, it's unique, and it scares the crap out of me. But it's not just that. Horror, you have to have a unique understanding of the character situation. You have to be able to really make that character sympathetic, and you do that absolutely convincingly. I was on his side throughout the book. I was scared for him. And the basic premise is just that this man has lost his wife and his son, and he's trying to recover. He's doing the best that he can, but he misses them terribly. And suddenly, one night, the baby monitor comes to life. Now, I'm not much of a pitcher, but I have to tell you, just that alone, as a horror fan, that would make me read it. Because just the fact that you're using a baby monitor, I'm sorry, that's a stroke of genius for me from the beginning. I have five sons. You have three daughters now?
Yeah, I have three daughters.
Yeah, we're both familiar with baby monitors. You scared the living bejesus out of me with that baby monitor. You really did. How did this formulate in your mind?
Well, as you mentioned, my Twitter handle is Somnicide, and I created that one night when I wasn't sleeping. And I get some insomnia, and I was laying there one night just listening to the monitor, and my first daughter, when she was learning to talk, she whispered to herself all the time to kind of practice. And so it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just start hearing this creepy whispering that didn't make any sense through the monitor. And I was like, oh, my God, this is the scariest thing ever. And I'm like, I'm a dad. I need to go check on my daughter. But I'm really scared. There's, you know, some horrible thing in her room. And so I went and checked on her, and she was fine. She was just sitting there practicing her talking. And it just kind of hit me how that line is there between me and my daughter, and how that's kind of like a safety net so I can sleep better at night because I know I can hear her in the other room or whatever. But then to hear something unexpected through it is kind of creepy because it's in your house. So it's not like you're hearing something outside. You're not hearing the tapping at the window or anything. You're hearing something that's literally in one of the most vulnerable rooms in your house at a vulnerable time. And that, to me, I just thought was a really frightening concept. And it kind of grew from there. If you're not expecting to hear anything, and when else would you you know, you wouldn't be expecting to hear anything if you'd lost your child in a tragedy, and just to suddenly hear something through there, I was really drawn to the idea of that combination of, like, hope and fear that you would have if you had a chance to communicate with somebody like that. And the monitors are just one way, so he couldn't really communicate back. So
that's what you did brilliantly. I mean, the thing is, it's not just as simple as this guy suddenly gets skeeved out because there are unusual things coming through the baby monitor. It doesn't work that way. I think you just had the most brilliant kind of escalation is a good word for it, because at first it was comforting. It was really comforting to him, and then it became less so, but you did it with a very deft touch. I mean, it was creepy. There was no doubt about it, but your character was so distraught and trying to regain normalhood, as it were, and to have this, it really comforted him. It wasn't until later it started escalating in a big way, and just the way that you treat that, I've always thought the best scary movies, and I'm not a scary movie person. I'm a horror reader. I read it. I don't particularly care for seeing it because I don't know about you, but I sit there and kind of mock whatever's on the screen, okay? I mock it. I critique the special effects or lack thereof, but reading it really gets to me, and it takes a really regular guy who has surreal things happening to him, and yet you make that seem normal. I don't know how you manage it. I mean, do you think that has something to do with being a father and with being able to lay there with insomnia and just kind of think it through and develop that story in your mind?
I think it did. And then I do a lot of reading. We spoke a little bit before the program about Stephen King, and I read a lot of him, and a lot of his stories are similar in that you're taking just a regular person and you're putting them in this really bizarre sort of situation and kind of seeing how they react and how, you know, it's not necessarily me, because obviously there are parts of me in this character, but it's not entirely me. And so I was drawing on a lot of different influences.
Yeah, but you sunk into this character with an ease that I'm frankly envious of. I mean, the lines, and it's not just that, because I happen to be a line whore. I said it, I'm a line whore. Whenever I come across a good line, it just like echoes in my mind forever and ever. I never say this quite right, but one of the lines that really struck me was, what was it, when hope looks in the mirror? What was that? Say it for me, would you? Do you remember that line?
I think desperation is what it sees. Hang on, I can bring up the manuscript.
Yeah, that's it. It was absolutely amazing. And that's not the only line. You have so many lines in there that are so relatable, and yet I never would have put that particular... I mean, it's the essence of writing. It's the essence of voice, is to be able to put out there what you see with your own eyes and how you... It's like a fingerprint. That's what voice is. The way that you put words together is just unlike anyone else. And I've told you, I think you're Stephen King-like. I don't think that's an overestimation. I mean, for listeners who have heard this show before, I don't go around overestimating. I just don't. I don't assign things where I don't think they belong. But if you read The Monitor, you are absolutely going to come out of it with the feeling that, hey, this guy has raw talent. It's well-executed talent. The premise is incredible, and you do it. You pull it off so well.
Thank you. Yeah, here's that line. Believe me, I know how it sounds. The desperation is what hope sees when it looks in the mirror.
I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it's so good. It's so good. Desperation is what hope looks like, or when it, wait, no. See, I get it messed up every, this is why I cannot stand you. No, because you wrote it so well, I could never come up with it. I can't even quote it back, but that's one of the lines. It's just one of many. And the thing is that it amazes me, and I think this afflicts talented people more often than not, because you have huge potential. You have huge amounts of talents. And I did bring you on the show to beat you over the head with it, because I want to see more work from you. I want to see full-length novels. You sucked me in from the beginning. I totally sympathized with your main character. I absolutely wanted the best for him, and it didn't quite work out, but like you said, I mean, it is Stephen King-esque. because you take a man in a regular situation and you think of an angle Stephen hasn't even come up with yet, and you execute it just amazingly. I was and remain creeped out by this story, but I really want to know what, I mean, you have to have, you mentioned Stephen King, but you also mentioned you have another inspiration, Scott, what was his name again?
Scott Nicholson. He's another writer. He's a more of an indie writer, and he does a lot of publishing stuff. And he's really kind of an inspiration to me. There are a few other really really great solid indie writers who kind of gave me the idea that yeah, it's possible if you work hard, and you know you have that bit of talent, but you really spend the time crafting the lines and developing the characters and making people feel about it that. This is going to be way off the topic of my novel, but I think, and I'm kind of being inspired by these people, that there is that place for like a middle-class sort of writer right now, you know, with the advent of the electronic publishing and all of the social networking, all the, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Goodreads and all of these different, you know, kind of venues where people can get their voice out, and you can kind of get around the gatekeeper somewhat, and it's very libertarian in the way that if it's good, it'll sell, and, you know, people will write more, and it kind of, you know, rises like that, and if it's not good, then it'll fall off, and it won't have the supply and demand, and it's really good. I think it's a really good time to be a blue-collar writer.
It is, and I mean, you've got the talent to get it out there and continue writing, so that's... That's the thing, because I was fortunate enough to see early drafts of The Monitor, and I told you off the air that it didn't change appreciably, which to me indicates real talent, because you got it out on the page. It did not change significantly from the drafts I saw to publication. That is something you have to have if you're going to be an indie author, because you have the ability to edit yourself. The only thing I think is... You, when I say it didn't change appreciably, it's like you procrastinate. You always think it could be better, which are hallmarks of a truly great writer, but it's already there. I don't know if you see that. It was already there. It was, if you look at the early drafts and then you look at the final product, you didn't change a whole lot, because you have the talent every indie author needs, and that is you can put it down, and it doesn't matter how many times you revised it. When it got to me, a beta reader, if you will, it was wonderful. It was wonderful as it was. You have the ability to self-edit. The promotion, I know you work a full-time job, promoting it, being kind of, I don't know whether I'm saying mid-list indie author, but I think that's kind of what you're going for. With that comes a lot of marketing and promotion. What do you have in place for that? Or is it just, to me, that seems almost overwhelming.
You know, it is, and I'm just really on the cusp of this and just starting out. But things, you know, going on talk shows like this one, you know, you find people who like your work and who want to talk about it, because that's what it comes down to, is I want to write something that people want to tell their friends about, and if they tell their friends about it, then hopefully their friends will go out and read it. So I've got, as you mentioned, the Twitter account at Somnified, which I promise I will start writing there more often.
You know, I'll be on you for that, right? You
yeah,
do realize. Okay, that's good.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. And then also, I'm going to be setting up a fan page in the next couple of days, or, you know, an author page on Facebook specifically for this. And
have you added The Monitor to Goodreads? Because I was dying to put it up there, and I couldn't find it.
I have not, actually. I should do
please
that.
Add it, because, I mean, I just blasted a series that, I mean, I'm very honest on my Goodreads page. Not everyone's going to agree with me. That's because they maybe read a different genre or not. But I was dying to get The Monitor up there so I could write about it, so I could leave a review for you. And this is just sheer, you know, I like every person I have on the show. I've read their work. I love their work. And this is something you want to put on Goodreads. You want those reviews so that people will check out your book. Because, you know, horror never went away. I heard a you've read my work. I heard I saw on Twitter the other day somebody said, oh, zombies are so 3 years ago. And I didn't say anything. But what I wanted to say was, yeah, Walking Dead and Generation Z really proved that, don't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Horror,
you know,
is never dead. It's finding the good of horror, and you write it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think ultimately horror really is just about the human condition, and so as long as there are people out there with that human condition, you know, there's going to be a market for horror, because we all wonder, you know, about things that are beyond the normal, and that's not talking about like slasher films and slasher stories, which there's definitely a place for those, and those also kind of fall under the big umbrella of horror, and we all just kind of wonder how we would do in that situation, or, you know, our minds go to dark places just because of how we're wired. It's probably some sort of self-protection mechanism, you know, and so it's to all your readers out there,
read horror and
save your own life, because you'll be prepared for those awful situations that come up.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're including all of us in your general assessment, but not, you know, the one thing is, not all of us can come up with a baby monitor and a terrifying story with the regular guy in the way that you have. You have to have a specific, a more attuned mind to really write horror and get away with it. You have to. Because one of the most difficult things, I think, in horror is to make the characters likable, to make them a regular Joe. Stephen King excels at it, and you have excelled at it. When it comes to character work, do they spring fully formed into your head, or is it something you have to put a lot of work into?
It kind of depends. You know, the main character, he just kind of fleshed out as I was going. The other main supporting character in there, Nadine, I worked really hard on her, because there are a couple of scenes with her where I really didn't want the reader to not like her. I didn't want them to dislike her. You know, because, and this was an issue that my wife had with it, you know, because the main character, John, his wife and his family just died, and then he kind of starts developing a relationship sort of with this other person who's kind of a surrogate for his wife, but I didn't want her to just be a surrogate. I wanted her to be a fully fleshed out character. I wanted her to feel real and to, you know, care for him. And then I worked really hard on the Nadine character. Actually,
it worked.
Because
it worked. At no time did I get the sense writing it. I have a couple comments on that, because at no time, she was a fully fleshed character. You got her. She did not come off as, when you introduced the character Nadine, who happens to work with our main character, when you introduced her, you got the sense of her as a fully fleshed person. She wasn't a snob. She wasn't a bitch. She wasn't awful. She wasn't clearly coming on to him. She was simply a colleague he worked with who works in human resources and wasn't sure if he'd stick around after his wife and son's awful accident or not. That in and of itself makes Nadine sympathetic. And I never got the feeling that she was some sort of a rebound, or that there was even really something of huge significance relationship-wise there. This isn't where he's trying to pick up another woman and fill the hole in his life at all. She's there at a time of need. And I have to say this, because, yes, there is some sex in the book, but I have to tell you, you did it very well.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't know, because, you know, I am not a sex scene writer. I know Eden Bailey does it very well, Kay Sheridan. There are a lot of people who do it really well. I'm not a sex, I mean, in one of my, you've read Year of the Hybrid, which I've got out on submission now, and my sex scene, one of them, the first time, so we did it. There you go. That's my sex scene. So we did
it. But it really depends
right?
on the character.
You did it, and you know what really, I want to be very clear on this. It excited me as a reader, not as a 50 Shades of Grey, somebody whip me now, please. I want to be really clear. As a reader, it is refreshing to see a sex scene from the point of view of a man.
Well, all of my sex scenes.
What do you say to that, right? But it's true.
Yeah,
you don't get that a lot. You usually get it. I know Julie Hutchings does it well, too, because I've had a little preview of her work, The Animal. But that said, it's very rare to get it from a male point of view and done tastefully and gracefully. You gave this man another added dimension of character when a sex scene came around. I mean, there was no, you know, a lot of times those things I kind of almost want to look away from, depending on how they're done. You did it very naturally, very gracefully. Everything made perfect sense. It was a logical progression, and nothing was cheesy. I mean, how long did it take you to work on that? Did a lot of work go into that, or did it just kind of, no pun intended, come to you naturally?
No, that scene was one that I worked on a lot also. I think you read one of the earlier scenes that was a bit more over the top as well. And a lot of times when I write, and this is, I think, because of some of the background in screenwriting that I have, is you write things just completely over the top, and then you pull them back, because it's always easier to, when you're rewriting, to pull something back down to a more sane level than it is to try to bump it up, I have found, anyway.
And yeah, but as I recall, in my earlier view, I didn't think it, I don't recall thinking it was over the top. I think I complimented you on it.
Yeah. I was actually worried you were gonna gripe at me for toning it down just a little bit. But
either way, it's handled. But that's what I'm saying. Even in your early drafts, you don't go wrong. That's not something I can say of myself or many other writers who are listening right now. It's not something, it's not easy to get it right the first time out. Now, that said, I have no idea how long you were working on the monitor before you sent it to me. I suspect it was a long time because you're a perfectionist, and that's great. However, you need to know, you need to remember that you write it really well from the starting gate. So getting it in front of another pair of eyes, mine, for instance, it's not going to be a bad idea because, you know, every writer struggles with insecurity. I am not someone who kisses bum unnecessarily. You've got the talent. I want to see it out there. Why? Because I am a selfish pig at the end of the day, Patrick. I want to read more of your work for me. Not for you, not for anyone else. I just want to read more of your work for me. And I want to read it now. I have the patience of a gnat. You realize this, right? So what are you working on now to comply with my demands?
Well, right now I want to back up just a little bit. The part of the reason I think, for me especially, that it's hard to just put stuff out there is because as writers we're bearing our souls, and I want to make sure when I do that people like it, you know, which whatever, I need to work on getting more out there. However, because I am kind of glacial in my pace of writing, or releasing things rather, I'm not so bad at writing, but actually getting stuff out there, I have a short story that I'm working on that's set in a really intriguing world that Scott Nicholson, who I mentioned before, has set up. And it's a post-apocalyptic world. His series is called After. And one of the things that I really liked was at the end of it, he wrote a bit saying, basically, if this world is, you know, kind of inspired you or whatever, feel free to write a short story in it. And then, you know, it's got all the rules and everything for that. But that's one of the stories that I'm working on. And then, you know, get that out there, and then hopefully that will appear in an anthology at some point of After Stories. The other thing I'm working on is I'm actually working on a novel, and I'm hoping to get the first draft done on that. I'm not hoping. The first draft on that should be done in October, and look for, you know, then I'll send it off to editing, and then have hopefully.
I think you're missing a really important step somewhere in there, Patrick.
Send it off to beta readers and then send it off to editing.
Yes.
And and then, you know, look for that end of the year or first part of next year. And that one is a full length novel, and it's a bit different. It's like
how would you
it's
describe
kind of,
it?
It's a
premise?
Group of people. So the premise of it is a group of people who, due to some natural disasters going on, get stuck in one of those tiny little roadside diner kind of places out in the middle of nowhere. I do a lot of driving back and forth between Los Angeles, where I live, and New Mexico, where all of my family is. And there's a whole lot of nothing out there. And same sort of thing I thought about, getting stuck with a bunch of strangers in one of these places would really kind of suck. And that seems like a great premise for me for a story. So I'm working on that as the novel. That's kind of the basic idea for it.
Yeah, and how far along are you? I mean, you've got to be. And the other thing I just have to ask is, do you ever get like caught up in it's not good enough? Oh my God, I'm stuck. This is not going to work. Because from what I've seen, it just doesn't happen. You may think it happens, but I'm telling you,
I don't
think it happens the way you think it happens.
Yeah, I start a lot of stories, and a lot of my things do come from an idea of a situation. And then, you know, seeing the characters, I feel like characters reveal themselves in these situations. So I like to start off with a situation and then kind of evolve it. And sometimes there's not anything there, and sometimes there is. In this one, I'm really excited. The characters are really, you know, like we talked about before, some of them are just really demanding to be told in a certain way, and other ones I'm kind of having to coax it out of them. And it's a really interesting dynamic cast, which is fun, you know, with people that I'm working with.
Now, how are you doing this? Are you doing it in third person? How are you handling it?
Yeah, this one's going to be third person. I think I mentioned to you before, The Monitor was the first person story that I wrote, and those were really hard, so I don't know if I'm going to do another one of those. I kind of like it. It's really hard with the descriptions to really flesh out descriptions in first person was something that I struggled with a lot.
You did it so well. You know, if I had eaten before this show, I would be mightily tempted to puke. I mean, you did it so well. This is your first time in first person, and you nailed it. I mean, this guy, you know, I would want to pat him on the shoulder and say, okay, you know, unplug the monitor and let's go have a cup of tea. You did it so well. And if it's your belief that you do better in third person, then I'm actually going to swallow now because I'm salivating a little bit at just the thought of what I can get my eyes on.
Yeah, it is. It depends on the story. This story was a very, very small personal kind of story. I mean, all of them are on some level from the main protagonist. But I actually, here's a little bit of trivia. I wrote this originally in first person, and then I started rewriting it in third person to kind of compare the form and see which form served the story better. And I just couldn't really get into it in the third person. And so I had to go back to the first person and clean that up. And that's, you know, whenever I was kind of talking about it, I do work pretty hard at this sort of thing. It's doing stuff like that where I end up throwing away like 90% of the work that I do, but I think that it's important for the story, and it does slow me down a little bit. But I really want to.
Well, it does,
really,
but you know what? You have to remember your brilliance. I mean, you know, I don't have you on a show for no reason whatsoever. People need to read the story. People need to see your voice because you have a compelling voice and the way that you tell the story. I mean, you know, there are some books. The Fifth Wave by Rick Yancey. That's a big one out right now. I've mentioned it before on the show because it is amazing. Have you read it? Have you heard of it?
I haven't.
Yeah, The Fifth Wave is just getting loads and loads of reads, bestseller, blah, blah, blah. And it is really good. The premise is amazing. The character is amazing. And then he bites the bullet in the end of it. Like I said, I don't spare anyone. He really does. He goes to cliches. He goes to stuff I would expect to see in an action movie. It really disappointed me. That said, I will absolutely read the next book and hope not to be disappointed. His premise is just too good. Why do I bring it up? Because your premise is amazing. Because, and they're different genres. His is more of an urban fantasy. But I think there are horror elements there. Anytime there's a freaking alien invasion, there's some horror involved, okay?
Yeah.
That said, I like to see a logical progression. I don't like to see things devolve into some sort of action movie out of nowhere when someone's been doing really well with their work. Yours does not repeat that mistake. Instead, at the end of The Monitor, I was going absolutely crazy. There were so many things that I would like to see answered, and I don't want to give away the ending because you need to read this book. Have I said it before? I'm going to say it again. You need to read The Monitor because it's short. Doesn't take that long. I still think it should be a novel because I'm very stubborn. Or you can create a bunch of novellas about it, maybe from different points of view. I mean, you could have Nadine's mm-hmm. point of view before it all happened. You could get another view. And you know what? I mean, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, even if they are a fictional character. But let's talk a little bit about, it's John, right?
Right.
I'm awful with character names.
You know what, I don't think I say his name in the entire
book,
actually.
Well, that's the thing, and that's why I've been saying the man. But the main character's son comes off as malevolent in this. Let's just put it that way, okay? You could do an absolutely amazing little novella involving Nadine, because there might just be a reason where she would have had reason, that is, to see him, to see the son. And you could kind of foreshadow the fact that maybe he wasn't the bright, shiny little cherub he looked like.
That's an option.
No, okay, all right. I see how you're going to play this. We're going to argue
about
a novella. Well, yeah,
okay.
But I'm going to throw it out there, and I'm throwing it out there because, well, writers brainstorm for one thing, and the other thing is I dearly want to see more of your work, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to argue with Patrick all through our break here. We're going to take a quick break while I tell him he needs to write more, and he needs to write it right now and make it available for my perusal immediately. Until then, you guys enjoy the commercial. We will be back right here on WGGM. You are listening to Lydia's Literary Lowdown.
Hello, everyone. B. Delosier here with a rundown of GGM Radio's brand new schedule. Boy, have we got some wonderful new programs with great new hosts. A little something for everyone. On Mondays at 11 a.m. Central, it's Messages of Light with Amanda Dowell for an hour of psychic chat and inspirational guests. Mondays at 7 p.m. Central, it's time for Primarily Paranormal with psychic Tina Marie. Share an hour with Tina and Bob Weber of Gulf Coast Paranormal. On the second and fourth Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Central, it's the Back to Brilliance Hour with Lynn Hoft and Vivian Hildebrand, an hour devoted to your spiritual growth. Wednesdays start at 11 a.m. Central with Maggie Holbeck and Crystal Clear Coaching, featuring motivational inspiration to get your life back on track. At 1 p.m. Central, join Claudia Cleary on Wednesdays with Namaste Nutrition for an hour of soothing chat all about good health, positivity, and spiritual balance. Thursdays, start your day at 9 a.m. Central with Nancy Murdoch and Mastering the Art of Joyfulness. Let Nancy and her special guests lift you out of that rut and get you back in your groove. At 8 p.m. Central, join Dr. Gregory Scott for the Light Giver Universal Healer Hour. Gregory offers spiritual education to further you along your path to enlightenment and empowerment. Fridays at 12 noon Central, it's Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Join Brenda for an hour of inspiration and motivation, featuring a lineup of today's most popular authors and guests. Friday night at 7 p.m. Central, enjoy an hour of psychic chat with spot-on reader Tasha Harris and the Angels Network. Saturdays begin at noon Central with B. Delosier, yours truly, and the Metaphysical Edge for psychic chat and interesting guests ranging from UFO research, paranormal experiencers, and all things metaphysical. At 2 p.m. Central on Saturday, it's Audrey Quinn and My Beauty Angel, an hour created just for you with tips and tricks on how to be the best you can be with what God has given you. Sunday is a day of service here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. Each week, featuring a different interfaith minister, bringing joy, upliftment, and unfoldment for body, mind, and spirit. The first Sunday of the month is Conversations Beyond the Edge with Dr. Gregory Scott. The second Sunday of the month is the Empowerment Hour with Reverend Barbara B. Delosier. Third Sunday of the month is the Light Givers International Sunday Service and Worldwide Source a Nation Celebration. The fourth Sunday of the month is In His Presence with evangelist Patricia Benneman. Hope you will join us live for all of our Greater Good Ministries radio programs, but if you can't be with us in person, you can hear any of our programs on demand in archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/ggmradio. And remember, all of our programs now stream live from our home site, www.ggmradio.com. Wishing everyone warmest blessings, always in love, light, and sound. Music provided by Arvel Bird, musician extraordinaire. Visit him at arvelbird.com and get a hold of all of Arvel's wonderful music.
Welcome back to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. Patrick and I have had our blowout knockdown fight in the break. Not really, because I don't have any sharp implements right now. My family denies me those, and it's probably because I read too much compelling, gritty, wonderful horror like the kind that Patrick Burdine produces. So, again, and you also have your own site, by the way. You have patrickburdine.com.
Yes, but yes, it's getting reworked right now, so it should be much better soon. Right now, it's just kind of like vomited up on there, and it's a little bit old. So, yeah, that's one of the things.
That's just another thing you have to do, isn't it? I mean, because during the break, after we had our knockdown drag-out fight, I finally got around to asking Patrick, my gosh, I know so many indie authors, and the thing that, you know, I only have two working brain cells. The thing I keep forgetting to ask them is, holy crap, I mean, you're doing this yourself from start to finish. What is it like to, from making the decision, I'm going to do this, to researching where you're going to do it, and then turning in your work? What is that like? Is it nail-biting?
Well, it's, you know what, it's actually not too bad. Amazon makes it really easy to do, the self-publishing on the Kindle. And then I read a few different books. There's a person named Mike Shea. And his last name is spelled S-H-E-A, and he wrote a book that really helped me out with a lot of it. You know, his is kind of start to finish, and his also covers different places other than Amazon if you want to post it up. And he actually writes, I think, predominantly, like, role-playing stuff, Dungeons & Dragons. I think one of his websites is Lazy Dungeon Master or something, which is not actually how I found him. You know, you mentioned before, I have three kids, I have a full-time job. I have a full-time job as a writer as well, so I'm trying to grow that into. And I found that things were starting to slip through the cracks. So I was looking for tools specifically that other writers had used. And I found his website and his personal take on getting things done, which is a productivity, you know, lifestyle. I did some research on it, and he was really helpful. But if you want to do it just on Amazon, especially, and I'm sure the other big ones are equally easy. I haven't put it up on that because I agreed to one of the things when you set up Amazon, you can agree to make it exclusive to them for a while, and then it, you know, slightly changes your, gives you different promotion opportunities that you don't have if you just make it available to everybody. And so I figured I would just kind of go this route the first time. They make it really simple though. I do work in computers, so I have a little bit of computer knowledge. I knew how to convert the file that I had written in the word processor program that I use, which I actually use a program called iAwriter, which is the reason I chose it. It's not really full featured. There isn't really much to it, but it does. It's a word processor. But I can use it on my iPad. I can use it on my computer. I can even use it on my phone. And I wanted something that all of them would sync up to the cloud, and it would be really simple, and I wouldn't have to put a lot of thought into it. So converting that into the HTML to put it up onto the site, which sounds much more complex than it really was. Basically, all I did was I went to file, export, turned it into HTML, cleaned up some of the weird stuff, and then set up my author page on Amazon, which, again, is really simple. If you just look up self-publish on Amazon, like Google that and then go to the Amazon thing, it tells you how to do it. There's a specific site you go to within Amazon. You set up your author page, and it walks you through a really easy process of uploading your book. It even has a spell check there, and it says, you know, there these words seem like they're spell check or misspelled. Do you want to check them out? And then, you know, you go through it, and it's pretty easy, the actual mechanics of putting it up.
Yeah, I don't know. My mouth is still hanging open from you hitting something explore to throw it into Hotmail and then correct a few problems. My mouth fell open, and that kept reverberating through my mind. And then I did hear you go on, but, you know, I'm still agog.
Yeah, it sounds much more complex than it is. And there are some great just free resources online, you know, where you can go and read and figure it out. But it's not too bad. The cover, I live in Los Angeles, and I have a lot of incredibly talented friends. And so I kind of checked with them and to find one who would be interested in doing a cover with me. And then I gave him kind of the elements that I wanted. And I tried to stay out of his process as much as possible. I was like, I kind of wanted to have this monitor, and I want it to be on, like, the dresser. And kind of I was thinking maybe the shadow is kind of creepy up over it or something, I think was probably the extent of the art direction that I gave him. And then we went through maybe 20 revisions back and forth to come up to what we came up with. But, yeah, he just did a fantastic job. And I'm
really
happy.
Oh, that cover is amazing. I was so excited when I saw the cover because it is so, I mean, it's creepy. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You've got a baby monitor, and I'm just going to say this, casting a shadow back on the wall that's terrifying. It's just, like, it's terrifying. It's so smartly done, this cover. It's amazing to me. I mean, seriously, it's amazing. It's a creepy cover made by just a desk and a baby monitor. And yet you take those two things. It's the perfect, the cover art reflects the story perfectly because you're taking simple elements and you're mixing them together into like a gourmet feast for the eyes. You really are because it's just absolutely, the cover just adds to the rest of the book. I see that cover. I want to buy it because it's such a clever cover.
Thanks. I appreciate it, and I'll pass it along. Sean McCauley was my artist, and, you know, he's a phenomenal guy, and he took my feedback a lot better than I take most of my editor's feedback, so I have to credit him on that. There were no tears on his part, and I don't think he threw anything. So.
Yeah, and you know what I learned? The amazing bit to me is what I learned about the cover art, because you showed me kind of an idea of what it was going to look like beforehand, right? And I liked it. I threw a couple suggestions out, but what he did definitely turned it into art. So, I mean, so many times we hear about cover art, and I don't know about other writers, but I think, yeah, cover art, woohoo. Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Okay? I just want to get to the story, right? I just want to get my story out there. But I saw the original kind of, I don't know what you call it, galley for the cover. And what that was creepy. But what the artist turned it into is the very definition of art. It's amazing. He gave it this, like, weather-beaten look that really suits the story and the cover. It's striking. It really is. And yet there's a simplicity to it. It's marvelous. If you're not going to buy the book, the least you can do, and you really should buy the book, I'm just the novella. I know I should be saying that, but I'm trying to subliminally kick you in the bum to write a full-length novel on this. That said, you should at least go to Amazon, type in the monitor Patrick Burdine, and look at that cover. Because if that doesn't inspire you to read it, not to mention the description and so on, I don't know what's going to. It's amazing. Were you excited when you got the cover art back?
I was very excited. The first draft, kind of before he'd stressed it when everything was really clean looking, I'm not going to lie, I was a little concerned that it felt a little Scooby-Doo because it does kind of have an almost cartoonish feel, which is kind of something that I wanted in with it. And I was going for those old, you know, 70s, 80s kind of pulp horror. That's kind of what I wanted for it. And there are so many different things to consider when you're doing the the cover specifically for electronic publication, because you have to think about what it's going to look like when it's the size of a postage stamp, and then also what it's going to look like whenever it's on the product page. So it needs to scale nicely. So it's, you know, if somebody out there is considering doing it themselves, keep that in mind. Don't put too much on the cover, because when it gets shrunk down, it'll be hard to read. You need to make sure your text is a pretty plain text. I think we went through 12 different font versions, and some of them looked fantastic at full size, but as soon as you shrunk it down, it was illegible. And I didn't want that. I wanted it to look good at all of the different sizes. So bear those things in mind. Bear in mind what the audience is going to be looking at, because, you know, if it does end up on, you know, like a list, because there are a lot of great lists out there where people write up their favorite things or whatever, and for those, you usually do have about the size of a postage stamp, and you don't want your monitor to look, or your cover to look like, you know, just like five splashes of color that you can't tell anything about. So take that in mind. I mean, a lot of thought really needs to go into each step, especially if you're doing it as an indie, because you don't have the whole team behind you. You don't have an art department, and you don't have the, you know, traditional publisher looking at it and showing you 20 different versions. These are all things you have to do yourself. And whether you're going to do the art yourself or, you know, go through and hire somebody else, however you're going to do it, you really want to make sure you get the best product, because I am competing with Stephen King's and, you know, Dean Koontz, and even some of my idols like Larry Correa and Scott Nicholson, Michelle Wright, all of these other authors. And I wanted my product to be able to stand up to those, and to not feel, I didn't want to have to give the caveat, well, yeah, but I did it myself, whenever it was being compared to these other books. So if you're going to do it yourself, I think one of the biggest pieces of advice that I would give you is to just really think of yourself as a professional and put out as professional of a product as you can, because you, whether you like it or not, you're going to be compared to those professionals, and rightfully so, because, you know, people only have so much money, and if they're going to give you money over Stephen King, you really have to give them a compelling reason.
Yeah, well, it's not just the story in this case, it's the price. I mean, I pulled it up immediately just to admire the cover again. I have my Kindle right beside me. That's something I might want to consider doing more often, but it's $2.99.
Yeah.
What is your decision there? Because I think that's a really good price point. That, I didn't have any hesitation. I saw it by, that's it. And the other thing I really want to know, because I am a huge fan, are you ever going to offer the monitor in print so that I can order it? And then, you know, I don't know if we'll do shipping back and forth or not, but I want you to sign it big time.
It really depends on if there's
a demand
for it. The
success, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, because, again, you know, I'm doing it myself, so anything that I pay for comes out of my pocket. And I'm not against that, but I don't want to print up. You know, like I have friends who are musicians, and they go out and they buy 1,000 CDs, and they sell 100 of them, which is awesome and more than they expected to sell, but then they're sitting around with 900 other CDs.
Right.
Whereas if they just printed up the 100, then they would have sold out of their first run and could go to the second one. And you know, as an indie writer, or really an indie anything, you have to be thinking the business aspect more, I think, than if you go the traditional route. Because if you go the traditional route, you have a numbers person who's thinking about that. But really, and I think it was Scott Nicholson who said in one of his blog posts that you have to think of yourself, if you're an indie writer, as a small business owner. And everything you do is a part of your small business. So you don't have a marketing team, you are the marketing team, just like in a traditional, just like if you owned a small individual grocery store. You know, you've got all of the same challenges. You've got to pay for your marketing, but you don't want to pay too much for marketing, because then you don't make enough money to stay in business. And ultimately, I want to stay in business as a writer. The price point, I struggled with that a lot, because there's a bunch of stuff that you can get for 99 cents out there, and I may do from time to time, like, you know, special deals.
I can see doing, you know, for me, I can see doing the 99 cent now and again, but it's definitely, you know, to me, it's worth more than $2.99. But to get people in the door, that's a really good price point.
Yeah, and I value it. I have a pride in my workmanship, and that's ultimately what I felt like it was worth. And so I hope anybody who reads it doesn't feel like, you know, that, that money is spent poorly, because, and that, you know, again, like, it, it's a really odd thing with electronic books, especially on the price, coming up with the price point, because, you know, for one, I'm an artist, and I want to get it out there, and I want people to tell me how awesome and great I am. And so for that, bearing that in mind, I'm like, I'll just give it to everybody. But I also want to not have to work at a computer job anymore so I can write more, so so you can read more and you can stop sending people over to break my legs.
Well, and, yeah, because, I mean, there's no point. I mean, you don't give away. You know, I know that there are lots of people, because if I go to my Kindle and I look up what's free, there's a lot out there. Well, you know what? It's gotten to the point I feel really bad doing that. I mean, I'm just snarking up their work. I'm a Kindle Daily Deal whore, too. I mean, I'm there every day. I'm always looking for that, that just because I'm cheap. What can I say? But I also go to my local bookstore and try and support them. I try and support indies. You know, I definitely buy books other than just through my Kindle. But because I'm finding myself buying a lot more on the Kindle, not just because they're cheap, but because I've heard great word of mouth about them. I think The Monitor is one of those books that can do that. And you've got all 5 stars, which is amazing and very well deserved. I don't think anyone should expect for someone to give away a God-given talent, and that's what you've got, for, or Buddha. I mean, I don't care who you worship. You've got big talent. You should use it. And you should. It shouldn't be expected that you're just going to hand this over to me for free. That kind of thing I really resent. I mean, that's the kind of attitude that has, you know, I went to Houston. I was on Houston on vacation, as listeners know, not that long ago, and their borders was closed. And sometimes I think all these authors who are glutting the market with these zero, don't pay anything, it's free. You know, sometimes I wonder if they're not contributing to that. Not people like you who charge for a great product, but people who just want it out there and glut the market with it. And I'm not by any means saying that there isn't good stuff to be found among the freebies. I'm not saying that. I am saying that I personally feel like a piece of crap if I were to load my Kindle up with a bunch of freebies and here these authors are. I mean, I talk to too many authors to, in good conscience, do that to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things I go back and forth on. You know, basically, it's somebody else's work. If they want to give it away, that's awesome, and I may give this away. Not this, but I have other short stories that I've written, and a couple of them are online, you know, in various places. I'll link those from my website. I've got a science fiction one, for instance, that I won a small contest of, and so I write in these other genres, and I discovered Scott Nicholson because he had his as, like, a daily deal free, and like, especially because he has a very... is a very good body of work. He's got a lot of different books, different, you know, everything's kind of a dark, kind of creepy sort of style, but within that, he has a number of different, you know, subgenres. And I wouldn't have discovered him probably if he didn't offer those free. So I can see the value in that. A lot of the free ones are just, they're poorly edited. It feels like a first draft that somebody threw up there. And I think, again, getting back to how you were saying I'm kind of a perfectionist and the amount of time that I do work on these, I think that is the problem, is glutting the market with too many of those things which have good kernels of ideas or are even okay execution, but they don't spend the time to really craft it into a good product. And I think that's probably one of the biggest struggles that a lot of the independent authors face when they're starting out, is being lumped in with other people who are hobbyist writers, which is awesome, and that's great. Get your work out there, let everybody read it. That's brilliant, and I'm happy for you doing that. But really, if you want to stand out, you've got to spend the time, you've got to work on it, you've got to really craft and hone your craft. And it's, I know it's like every lame cliche you ever hear, but You have to be better than the Stephen King. Your work has to stand out above it, because otherwise somebody's going to go with Stephen King because he's freaking Stephen King. Like, I buy every Stephen King book that comes out on the day it comes out because I'm such a big fan of his. But I know that if you're a fan of Stephen King, hopefully you'll be a fan of me as well. So I have to make sure my work stands up next to his. I don't want people to read it and be like, oh, this guy's trying to be Stephen King or whatever. but I want him to say this guy is as good as, or he tells stories in an interesting way similar to. And I want to be able to, you know, rub shoulders with those guys and be proud to have my work up there. And with a monitor, I'm happy to say that I am. I feel that it's that level of quality. So
it is. It absolutely is. And there's one other important consideration is that you, unless you want to run and go by another name, then, you know, your name is attached to whatever you're putting out there. It's your good name. And it really only takes one disastrous error to never leave the minds of what could be potential readers.
Right.
And I didn't think, you know, that's one thing that some people just, well, you can see on my Goodreads. I just read a kind of a trilogy. At the end of the book, Von Hettner, that's what it was, Invasion Colorado, Invasion California. He started out with two great books. They were amazing. I noticed the grammatical errors in the second book. In the third book, he went off the rails. I mean, there were, I don't know if a different publishing company got a hold of it. I don't know what happened. There were numerous grammatical errors, but that wasn't the worst. He set up a new storyline, and then he literally, right at the end, he set up a new storyline, and then he said, if you want to read more, email me, write a review, let your friends know about it. There was no resolution. He just stopped it. And it's like, that's the kind of mistake, I will never read his books again, that's the kind of mistake that can shoot you in the foot. So everything Patrick's saying, all the preparation, because I'm still trying to go the traditional route, but believe me, I'm listening, I'm absorbing everything you say, because my God, it takes forever. That said, impatience is not something you're allowed to have in publishing without paying a price for it. And a lot of right. these authors who are giving away their work for free, first of all, my God, I worry about them. I mean, how are you, like you said, it may be a hobby thing, but are they going without because they're not getting, you know, any money for their work? And second, I believe if you put something out there, you need to get something for it. It doesn't have to be a lot, but anything that helps you along, particularly if you have talent. But the number one thing is you have to make sure, especially as an indie author, that you get it right every time. The pressure's on you and you alone, and if you make a costly mistake, it can lose you readers, and that loses you income.
Right, for sure. And again, I want to say, you know, to people who are putting them up for free or the hobbyists, that's great. Continue to do that. That's wonderful. I'm taking a slightly different route. I really valued it, and I gave it what I think is a fair price point, and I hope my readers do too.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't want to rip anybody off. I want it to be a good value for their money, and I felt like it had value to put out. So
oh, it absolutely does. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. You need to read The Monitor. It's absolutely astounding. I guarantee, you know, if you're a fan of horror and you read The Monitor, it's a novella. When you get to the end, your mind is going to be turning. You're going to want more from Patrick Burdine. And on that note, sir, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lydia. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, yes, and you will be back. You just don't know it yet. I will bully you into it.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. You have a good one.
You
okay,
too.
Everybody. Next week, we are going to have the lovely Kristen Strassel. Now, again, I can wax poetic about all the perks I get in doing this podcast, and one of those is I was able to get an advanced copy of Because the Night. That is her debut. It's a new adult paranormal romance. It's set in Las Vegas. It is absolutely amazing, and I'm already drooling because she's completed a prequel to the series, and it's a YA novella. It's tentatively titled Seasons in the Sun. She's represented by, forgive me, Pam Van Hicklema, if I have just murdered your name. I have apologize for that. Did not aim for it to happen. She is part of the lovely writing duo of DeadlyEverAfter.com. If you heard my interview with Julie Hutchings, get prepared. I'm going to take Kristen on. I am going to beat her over the head with her own brilliance, too, although I have vowed to be less aggressive than I was with Julie. It's just they're both so good. Excellent writers, amazing premises. If you have not checked out DeadlyEverAfter.com, go there. It's absolutely worth reading because they give you treats all the time. Their blogs can be short stories. I mean, I am so sold on this duo and their separate works. Absolutely astounding. It's like a gift, you know. I went to score an interview with Julie Hutchings. I was so fortunate to meet Kristen Strassel and read her work. It is amazing. I cannot wait to talk to her next Saturday right here. Everybody have a great week. I am so glad that you joined me. And again, we will be back with the lovely Kristen Strassel next week right here on WGGM. You've been listening to Lydia's Literary Lowdown.